So happy to be with you all. I have to say, to begin with, that I'm not a particularly religious person. What I think is that what we need to be is spiritual. Religion is a formality. It's something you do to please God and so on. Religion is not the essence of what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about spirituality. Of all the groups of people in this world who are seeking money, fame, power, sex, importance, anything that you might name, no one has ever achieved what he is looking for except one group. Howard Hughes, who was the wealthiest man in the world, just a week before he died, a newspaper reporter asked him, "Are you happy?" He said, "No, I can't say I'm happy." Even his tone of voice said it. But there is one group of people who have set out to find God, and they have found something real. Religion doesn't talk about finding God. It talks about being obedient to him, doing holy things. True spirituality means, well, let me put it this way, Saint Jean Vianney, a great saint in France, once said, if you knew how much God loves you, you would die of joy. The search that all of us have, you know, in the Indian scriptures, the great Shankaracharya said that God is Satchidananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. This is our nature, and this explains all human motivation. Everybody in the world is seeking two things, one to avoid pain and the other to find happiness. And in this sense, you can say that everybody in the world is on the spiritual path. In fact, one disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda once asked him, "Will I ever fall from the spiritual path?" Yogananda answered, "How could you? Everyone in the world is on the spiritual path. Everybody is seeking happiness. But the thing is that they usually, in fact, almost always, seek it in ways that in the end will be a disappointment to them." There's a story about an American in boot camp in the Second World War. And he was going around the grounds picking up paper. "This isn't it. This isn't it." Finally, he began to think, well, this guy better see the camp psychiatrist. So he went into the camp psychiatrist's office, and he was picking up papers on the table, on the desk. "This isn't it. This isn't it." Finally, the psychiatrist couldn't get him to say anything else. And so finally, he recommended him for a medical discharge. When that discharge was given into his hands, the man said, "This is it." Well, this is what all of us are seeking. We are seeking to be discharged from those things which cause us pain and suffering. All of us want to understand how we can find happiness. And only one group of people in the world have actually found that goal. Those are the people we call the saints. This is not something that it doesn't require a special kind of person. He may not be a very holy kind of person. Sometimes somebody who is a very unholy kind of person finally decides, "I've had it with suffering, and I want to find God." In the Bhagavad Gita, a great scripture of India, it says, even the worst of sinners, if he steadfastly calls to me and meditates on me, quickly comes to me. One of the things that we must get away from is sin consciousness. You are not a sinner. You are a child of God. And your sins are something temporary. They're mistakes that you have made. I remember when I was 21, I decided I wanted to become a hermit. And I thought, well, who ever heard of a hermit who smokes? And so I decided I had to give up smoking. Well, it was like Mark Twain, who said, smoking's the easiest thing in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. And so every time I would go off smoking, my lunch and coffee that the cigarette tasted so good and I would go back to it. But the important thing, and I was very lucky in understanding this, I never said, I have failed. I always said, I haven't yet succeeded. I think that in true religion there is no room for beating your breast and saying how bad you are. Mind you, if you say you're a sinner, then you have all the excuse you need to go on sinning, don't you? You want to understand that you have the potential. And this is another very interesting point, and I keep referring to the Indian philosophy because it is the most practical in human terms and in terms of human upliftment. I remember there was this one man in Australia. I was giving a lecture there, and he said to me, well, I'm an atheist, and what have you got to say about God that I can understand and respect? And I said, well, why don't you think of God as the highest potential you can imagine for yourself? And he sort of was stunned by this answer, and finally said, well, I can live with that. Well, the thing is that we all have a higher and a lower potential. I remember many years ago when I was desperately seeking truth, and it occurred to me that everybody in the world was me in potential. I could have been the worst person in the world if the right circumstances, the right misunderstandings and everything had taken me in that direction. And I became very much afraid of how vulnerable human nature is. And I realized I needed help. And so I called deeply to God. I remember, well, I had sought truth all my life, really from childhood. And first I wanted to be an astronomer. And then I thought to be a social reformer. I wanted to have a kind of religion that would help everybody. And I thought of music and the arts and so on. But always I thought, without God, this won't work. And I had tried to avoid God. When my mother was bearing me in her womb, she used to pray, this first child I give to you. But I have to say, I did my best to live without God. But I found it just wasn't possible. I looked over history, and every single movement that really had a strong positive impact on the human race, every single one was a religious one or a spiritual one. What influence has Newton had, or Darwin, or all those materialistic scientists, compared to Buddha or Jesus Christ or Krishna or the great spiritual reformers of history? Not one. There is something in human nature that needs to aspire to something. Without aspiration, we are no better than the animals. And so you see, and this is another theme in the Bhagavad Gita, which I referred to a few moments ago, there is an upward pull in all of us, and there is also a downward pull. And I know that the religions and the societies and so on try to tell you what to do, but you don't need to be told if you just try to listen and watch your own nature. When you try to hurt somebody, you feel hurt. When you're jealous or selfish, you feel hurt. When you don't live according to your own highest expectations of yourself, you're the one who suffers. And there is within every human being this upward pull and the downward pull. You can see it in the very posture of people. People who live downwardly with their energy moving downward. Yes, in the physical body. They look down, they look heavy, they sit heavy, their words are sort of coarse. Everything about them is a downward pull. Whereas if you understand that there is something in you which aspires upward, heaven isn't above you, literally. Heaven is above you in your own self, that part of your nature that raises your consciousness toward the brain, toward here, toward the higher aspects. Think of your feeling. Feeling is in the heart, isn't it? When you have a lovesick swain, let's say, he never says, I have a broken knee. He will often say, I have a broken heart. It's in the heart that we feel. And what we find is that when that energy from the heart goes upward, then we feel better. And when it goes downward, we feel worse. So religion in the New Age needs to be taken out of the category of belief. It isn't enough to believe things. People used to believe the world was flat. That didn't make it so. There are many things that we can believe that are not true. What we need is experience. In fact, we need to bring science and religion together in this, that there is no opposition between beliefs, yes, but between experience, no. We have to understand that when you think right, feel right, live right, then everything goes better for you. And one of the wonderful things, because I'm the founder of about 8 communities now worldwide, and this is our 42nd year of existence, it is enough of an experiment, you might say, that in these 40 years, we've been able to see people in their thousands come and go. But those people who have lived according to these teachings, they always are happy, they're always at peace, they're always generous. People who go against those teachings, they themselves suffer. Remember, religion is a matter of what you yourself experience from life. You've got to base your religion on what you have experienced, of what you want. Nobody else can tell you what you should want in this world, but you do know in your heart that this thought is universal. You want to avoid pain, and you want to find happiness. Now, to some people, happiness is power and so on. But once they've gotten it, they don't have it. The only happy people in this world are those people who hope to achieve what they're looking for in the path that they're following. But in the one path where they have sought God, you find absolute agreement, to the point where they're willing, happy, honored, even to sacrifice their lives to help other people to come to that teaching. I remember back in when I was 22, and this was 1948, and I had reached the point of desperately wanting to know God. And it occurred to me, maybe I'm going crazy. I had never heard of people knowing God. I hadn't read religious things. I'd been sort of anti-religion and anti-religious. And I didn't know that there were people who actually communed with God. My mother would talk about it sometimes, and I'd talk about the miracles that saints performed and so on. And I'd say, come off it, Mother. No, that's just nonsense. But so I didn't know anything. But when I came to that point where I desperately needed to know what life was all about, I remember I was in Charleston, South Carolina at that time, and I took a long walk out into the evening, into the night. And I said, if there's a God, what must he be? Well, he can't be a policeman, he can't be a judge. It's got to be something more. I realized that he had to be consciousness, and that my consciousness was, I was conscious because I was a part of his consciousness. This was the whole Vedanta philosophy that just came to me as I was going on that walk that night. And I said, if this is true, if he is consciousness, if I am conscious only because he is conscious, if I am more aware of that higher consciousness when I'm in tune and less aware when I drink too much or gossip too much or I'm restless or whatever, then it's possible to be more aware and not less aware. And if this is true, then the only goal of my life has to be to find God. And I thought, am I going crazy? Nobody ever had done this as far as I knew. And I remember going out almost desperately into the country. I thought, maybe I'm too sophisticated, too much of a city dweller. I need to get close to nature. And I went upstate New York, and I went into the countryside at Indian Lake, and I used to look at the dewdrops on a leaf and think how beautiful it is. And I thought, but I can't feel it. It's out there. It isn't here. I felt that I was like a motor working on only one cylinder. And I thought, what can I do? And I decided that I would give my life to seeking him. I didn't know how. I had read in some, I didn't know anything of the Indian scriptures, but I read a short world Bible, as it was called, in my mother's library. And in that it talked about how it is possible to commune. And to do so, you have to meditate. Well, meditation, I didn't know what that was all about either. But I used to sit sort of cross-legged and cross-eyed on my bed and try to find something. My father had been posted to Egypt, Cairo, and my mother was to join him. This was the most wonderful thing in my life. The day that I put mother on that ship to go join dad in Cairo, I went uptown New York, and I entered a bookstore called Doubleday Duran, and having read a smattering of the Indian teachings, I went there and looked at what they had, and I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And there was something about the cover of that book that just somehow resonated with me. And I bought that book, and it just completely changed my life. I'd been against miracles because I thought, my rational mind thought they were not possible, but I had always doubted my rational mind. I used even as a child to play games with myself. I would say to my mother, for example, because I didn't like spinach, so I'd say, oh, mother, don't give me spinach today. Spinach is green, and green is the color of envy, and you don't want your boy growing up to be envious. I knew that was false reasoning, and I enjoyed using reason falsely, simply to show myself, convince myself, that I would not find truth through reason. But I had only reason to go by. If I'd gone by love, it would have been much easier. But I didn't know about that. And yet, through reason, I did find what I was looking for. And when I read that book, page 8, Lahiri Mahasaya, the guru of my guru's guru, doesn't mean anything to you, maybe. But the thing is that suddenly he materialized in a wheat field. To me, absolute bilge. But because he said it, I believed it. I was completely won. Not by what he said, not by the stories he told, but by that absolutely pure consciousness that showed in every reaction that he had. His book is full of divine bliss because he is so perfectly blissful in his own nature. Do read that book. It's the greatest book I've ever read. But anyway, I took the next bus, New York to Los Angeles, where he was living. And the first words I said to him were, I want to be your disciple. He accepted me that day. And I can say that this was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I had never heard of the word guru. In fact, I didn't know the word of yoga. I didn't know any of the Indian terms. But I knew I desperately needed help. I had seen these people who were of all sorts of debased consciousness, high consciousness, all kinds of consciousness. I wanted to be a writer, and I used to make it a point to mix with all kinds of people that I could just to understand human nature. And as I said earlier, I could see that these people were unhappy, miserable, depraved. And I could see also that I could have become like that. And so when I crossed the country to meet Yogananda, I had this twofold desire. One was to find God, and the other was to help everybody to find him. Religion in the New Age, to my mind, is to understand that religion is to fulfill your own destiny. It's not a question of doing something because society tells you to, not something doing something because you belong to a particular church and they tell you this is what you should do. It's a deep impulse within each person. But you know, just as when you try to thread a needle, if the threads are going in different directions, you can't get that thread through. And so here we have this aspiration, which is universal. Everybody has it. But the thing is, the threads are not all pointed that way. And so we have conflicting desires, conflicting attachments. We have this need to learn to bring ourselves into alignment with our own true aspirations. And this is what true religion should be all about. It should be experiential. Beliefs don't matter, but your experience of life. That, you know, I think there are as many types of Christianity as there are Christians, because everybody's experience of God, of truth, of life is unique. This is one of the absolutely wonderful things about the spiritual teachings. God is ever new. In every human being, that divine bliss is expressed in a particular way. In every human being, that aspiration expresses itself in a particular way. Don't join any organization that tries to make you into a mirror image of everybody else. Everybody has to find his truth for himself. And yet you'd find that those who know God, each one is unique. Everybody else is imitative. Saints bring out their own nature, their own divine self. But in everyone, it is different. People are always saying, well, how could this one be a saint? He's not like that one. No, everyone is different. This is the beauty of it all. When you are seeking the higher self, you will find that you're stripping away all those things that are your own false self-definitions. You aren't an American. You aren't French or Italian or Indian or anything. You aren't white or black or whatever other color. You aren't a man or a woman. You aren't a person with particular self-definitions. What you need to do is get rid of those self-definitions. You know, the more you can reduce yourself to the thought of zero, that I am nothing. I remember one time many years ago, I was in a church and lecturing, and there were 100 people there. And I remember that my guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, had said to me, well, when you speak, feel that God is speaking through you. And I thought, well, why shouldn't I just shut up and let God talk? So I tried to stand there. I stood there for 2 minutes in a group of people, 100 people, all waiting for your next word. If you don't say anything, they'll think you're frozen with fear. And many people were perspiring. But I just stood there comfortably waiting for God to say something. And I finally had to say, well, he won't be speaking. I have to do it. And so this is a prayer that Yogananda said, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. So we have to do it. We have to put out the energy. But what I have discovered, now mind you, I'm talking with some experience. I've written about 140 books. I've written over 400 pieces of music. I've taken over 15,000 color slides. I've founded communities. I'm not saying this to boast. I'm saying it to make a very important point. The less you feel you are the doer, the more you will find that that inspiration can come to you and he will be able to do things. God doesn't work through passive instruments. He works through active instruments. This is a very important point to make today, because we're surrounded by violence and hatred, and the world at the moment seems to be really going downhill. I'm sad to say it. I remember a newspaper review of a movie that I saw in India. It said, if such and such a movie wasn't violent enough for you, this one will please you. The world is sick. There is a war, however, going on up in heaven between those who are trying to find truth and joy and those who are opposed to it and living for darkness. Be an angel of light. Be a warrior of light. Be one whose life is dedicated to finding the fulfillment of all human aspiration, which is to know the bliss of your own being. It's absolutely thrilling when you feel this, to to look around you and see that everybody, in his own way, is trying to find that same bliss. We're all children of God. We're not sinners. We're his beloved children. And have that faith that you can come out of the swirling mists of delusion and discover who you really are as a part of his consciousness. This religion is the eternal religion. It is the religion that has to be the religion in the most distant galaxy of our universe, because there is no other truth possible. Everything was dreamed by God. Everything must merge back into him in the end. This is the essence of religion. Joy to you.
Thank you, Swamiji, for sharing with us. And we have a number of questions. First, from Tatiana from Brazil. She's asking, how do we love when one is being challenged karmically on all levels, physically, emotionally, and spiritually?
Mind you, the path to God is by no means an easy path. We have ignored God for who knows how many lifetimes. I certainly believe in reincarnation. Without that, I don't see that there could be any hope. It takes a lifetime even to overcome one strong habit. But we have been seeking in the wrong way. And so when we turn to God, he will ask us, do you really mean it? You know, there's a story of Saint Teresa of Avila. She went through many tests, and in her old age, she was fording a stream, and it was winter, and the rains were heavy, and her horse lost its footing, and she was swept into the stream. And suddenly she found herself on the opposite bank, and Jesus was standing there, and her own clothing was completely dry, and he looked at her with a smile, and he said, don't feel too badly, Teresa. This is how I treat all my friends. And she had a good wit. She said, ah, my Lord, that is why you have so few. So remember, I'm not offering you an easy path. What I'm offering you is the only possible path. Nothing else will work. And many people think, well, it's too much, so they go back to something, but that won't work for them. Only one thing will work, and that is when you find that you are a part of God, and your destiny is to merge into him.
A question here from Giuseppe in New Jersey. Should we be preaching the truth to worldly people, people attached to ego, or should we keep silent within ourselves?
You have to discriminate. Jesus said, don't throw your pearls before swine. If people are not ready, then it drains your energy to try to talk about these things. So don't talk too freely, but test the water first. And see if people are interested, then give them a little more, give them a little more. But be guarded about what you have to say, because you don't want them making fun of you. That diminishes your own energy. But respect their right to come to truth in their own way, and respect their right to be ignorant. There was one man who, Yogananda, was saying that much in the Bible is mythological. He said, for example, in the Garden of Eden, say the serpent talked to Eve. Well, serpents don't talk, do they? And this very fundamentalist Christian said to him, in those days, serpents could talk. Well, Yogananda wasn't going to argue it, but he took his hat off and he said, I bow to the colossal temple of ignorance that I see before me. So be respectful. Even that bow was respectful. He respected people's right to be as ignorant as they choose. But if they want it, then give it to them.
And Troy in Virginia is asking, what is the secret to establishing a consistent meditation practice? I can't seem to keep it up.
Okay, you brush your teeth every day. Let's say you spend 5 minutes brushing your teeth. Why not brush your soul also? Take a little time to think of spiritual hygiene. It's not that difficult. I'll bargain with you. Take 5 minutes a day. The thing that's beautiful about meditation is that the more you do, the more you find it attractive. It's not a labor. You begin to feel that you're resting in yourself, and this peace that comes, it can change your whole life. The more you can go in the trials and troubles and tribulations of daily life, the more you can reflect on the peace that you felt in your meditation, the happier you'll be. So you will find that that 5 minutes, you'll just say, oh, is it already up? Well, let me sit another five. Before you know it, you'll be sitting 15 and half an hour and an hour. Really, I would say that for a serious seeker, there should be at least an hour and a half given to God. If God were not to think of you for 1 minute, you wouldn't be here. 1 second, you wouldn't be here. Think of him a little bit. He's your only life and the source of everything you are. Give him a chance, that's what I say.
And Kathleen in New York is asking, I've been having some intense spiritual experiences like buzzing and lights. Is this normal, or is there a way to feel it more naturally?
I'd say whatever experience you have, relax into it. And the more relaxed into it you are, the more it will become your own nature. These are very small experiences, in fact. But important. They encourage you to try harder.
And Leslie's asking, what's your perspective on the Gulf oil spill?
Where is Leslie? Okay. My perspective on the Gulf oil spill has been conditioned by what I read. I'm not there. I don't really know. But I have to say it could create a huge cataclysm. It has been this sort of thing can release methane gas into the atmosphere. It can cause widespread destruction. And I must also say that I remember my guru in the church in Hollywood one time saying, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. This could be that cataclysm. At any rate, I don't want to feed negativity. There's nothing we can do about it. But I would say, remember, God is a stern. He wields a stern whip sometimes. Man has been forgetting God, and man is certainly going to have to suffer through depression, through international war, and through some cosmic event, either extraterrestrial or this doomsday thing that people talk about of the methane gas escaping into the atmosphere. And in the past, when this has happened, about 95% of life on the planet was destroyed. No joke.
Birch is asking, is it possible to attain Christ consciousness without meeting a yogi in person?
No. You have to have at least one physical contact. My guru told me that. And the thing is that when you have what is known as an avatar, who's born into this world, he comes with a particular power. Jesus Christ lived only 33 years, but his power continued. It was not the power of an ordinary saint. Those who were his followers, those who tuned into him, as it says in the Bible, in the Gospel of St. John, to as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. And that power is what is needed. You can't do it by your own ego. The ego is already infected by the very disease it is trying to overcome. So you need the attunement with somebody who is out of that ego, and with that you can be lifted. Now, a human contact, my guru told me this personally, is needed. But in the case of disciples of Jesus Christ, they were that contact. He was that kind of avatar or divine power which could continue to save people down through many generations, thousands of years. An avatar's duty is to be available to people all over the world. And yet how many people would know him all over the world? So, for example, myself, I'm a disciple of such a great master. I have his power to work with. It's not my power. But I have to say that the more I feel his presence, the more blissful I feel, and the more other people who are with me feel that bliss. These are serious things. Don't just think that any priest can give it to you, but one who is truly completely dedicated to finding God, and to finding God through a particular channel, the more that will be possible.
And Ken is asking, what was it like when Master touched your heart on that first occasion?
You know, the odd thing was, when I met my guru, and he accepted me as a disciple, he put his hand over my heart and it vibrated for 2 whole minutes. I didn't feel anything. But from that moment, my life was changed. My consciousness was changed. And it was a power I wasn't yet ready to feel. But in all honesty, I have to say I didn't feel it right then. But everything changed from then on. So that blessing was certainly there. And many times in his presence after that, I would feel just overwhelmed with bliss or with love. It was the most wonderful experience of my life, living with him and being his disciple.
Arati in California is asking, would you speak about the need to stand up and be counted?
I think that it's a good thing to stand up and be counted. I think she's quoting from a book of mine, Renunciation in the New Age. And I think that when we believe something, we shouldn't hide it from people. I think that in this age where everybody is spouting all sorts of negative philosophy and so on, we don't have to talk about it, but we have to let it be known this is how we feel. If people talk about how they went out and got drunk last night, we can't try to smile with them just to be a hail fellow well met. I would say don't respond. To be counted doesn't necessarily mean you have to get up on a podium and start talking, but you have to be firm to your commitments, firm to your loyalties. And Yogananda often said, loyalty is the first law of God.
Usha in Portland is asking, would you please talk about the relationship between Dwapara Yuga and Education for Life?
I wrote a book. It's called Education for Life. And it tries to encapsulate Yogananda's teachings on education. The important thing is to prepare children not just to grow up to get a good job and make money, but to make them whole human beings. In fact, we have schools all over the world. I don't know how many, but a number in every country. And those schools are teaching this system, Education for Life. I know that a friend of mine, her father from Spain, just discovered it the other day. And he's absolutely excited about it. Because if children can learn to be happy as human beings, isn't that much more important than teaching them all the tricks for making a lot of money? So this Education for Life helps people to understand, for example, and I can't give the whole thing right now, but for example, you have certain tools that you're born with. You need to hone those tools. The first 6 years of your life are pretty much spent in trying to get your body under control. The next 6 years are pretty much spent learning to get your emotions under control. And that's when it's a very good time to teach children stories of uplifting people, stories that will inspire them, stories that will try to make them better. And these are important things. Children's stories tend all too often to play down to their silliness. I wrote a book recently called The Time Tunnel, in which people go through this tunnel and suddenly find themselves in a position where they can go forward and backward in time and learn from history and learn from the future how they can become better people. All of education should train you to become a more complete human being. And the wonderful proof of our system is this, that in competition, in competitive exams between that are taken on a nationwide level, our children come out in the top 5 percentile. when they leave our school for various reasons, like their parents moving away or whatever it may be, growing too old for the system, they always become outstanding students. So really, I do urge all of you to look into this. And Usha, by the way, is a member of our community in Portland, Oregon. And she has done wonderful work in helping to promote this system. And she's written books on the subject herself. So thank you, Usha.
And Aditya and Maya in Atlanta are asking, are we different from mind? Is soul a different entity from mind?
From what? Mind?
From mind.
The mind is that part of the brain. Well, actually, the consciousness in man is divided into four segments. Mon, buddhi, ahankar, citta. Mind, in that sense, is that aspect of the mind of consciousness which merely receives impressions. You could put it this way. You have a mirror. Reflected in the mirror is a horse. The mind will see that it's a horse, but it won't know that it's a horse. Then comes buddhi, which is the intellect, and it's centered here between the eyebrows. And buddhi says, oh, that's a horse. Then ahankar comes in. Ahankar is the ego. And the ego says, oh, that's my horse. Then feeling comes in, which is of the heart. The buddhi is centered here. Ahankar of ego is centered in the medulla oblongata. That's why when people are proud, they sort of look down their noses at others. And the heart feeling is the citta. And when the citta says, oh, how happy I am to see my horse, that's when delusion begins. So consciousness beyond mind is super consciousness. It doesn't break things up the way the intellect does. The consciousness or super consciousness perceives everything as one. It's a very interesting concept to understand that, well, think of this. God is, according to Jesus Christ, like a child. How could a child have produced the complexity that we see around us in this universe? It's not possible. I remember one time I was out of the desert. I used to be much too intellectual, and my guru wanted to cure me of this. And one time in his kitchen, he had everybody turn the lights out, and then he rustled some paper bag and pulled out something, and bzz, 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 and there were these little sparks coming out of a toy pistol. And he turned the light back on, and he looked at me, and he said, what do you think? And I said, well, it's fine, sir. I was trying to put together this idea of this wise sage playing with a toy pistol. Then he pulled out another one and shot it, and that projectile went up and came down to the floor as a parachute. We all solemnly watched this descending parachute. And he looked at me, he said, suffer little children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of God. And this, it's just amazing to think that God, in his huge complexity, could have the nature of a child. And yet he does. He doesn't, he's not childish. You can't hurt his feelings, but you can approach him as your own. There's no complexity. You don't have to address these long-winded, pompous prayers to him. Just love him as he is. He likes that. I remember one time, many times, I've simply told God, you have to do this for me. And people would say that, not respectful. He's my own. Why shouldn't I talk to him that way? If you do, you'll find that he's on your side always.
Kate from Florida is asking, what book would you most recommend for the beginning student after autobiography?
I would say The Essence of the Bhagavad Gita. I wrote that book out of in attunement with him. And I remembered, you'd have to call it a miracle, because I wrote it in 2 months, less than 2 months. And it was a recollection of his commentaries on the Gita. Read that book, it'll change your life.
Deborah in Idaho is asking, talk about the importance of forgiveness, not just from the point of view of the one who is being forgiven, but more importantly, the one who is doing the forgiving.
I had a dream many years ago, in which I had a very close friend. But he took advantage of my friendship for him and treated me like dirt. And as I was approaching death in that lifetime, I had developed a deep bitterness. And suddenly I realized that if I died with that bitterness, I would be reborn in a position where I had to treat him the way he had treated me. And maybe he then would, in another life, treat me the same way. And so it would go on. And I thought, I forgive him now. Why waste all that time? I remember what a great release it was in my own heart. Forgiveness will be release for yourself. Don't hold grudges. It's not worth it.
We have time for one last question, Swamiji, from Seattle. We're told it's time to be courageous spiritually. In what way?
It takes a lot of courage to stand up for your ideals. It takes a lot of courage to say, this is what I'm doing, and whatever you do is your business. But I am seeking truth. I am seeking God. Everybody will be against you. You will be persecuted. But if you stand by what you believe, they will come your way. And if they don't, nonetheless, you have to be a man of courage or a woman of courage if you are to know your own self. The temptation is to let other people rule your ideas, rule your sentiments, rule your beliefs. Don't let it happen. Courage doesn't mean necessarily going in with a sword. It means remaining firm. I remember one time when I was about 13 years old, I only weighed 107 pounds. And there was a big boy who lived in the room right next to mine. He was 15. I weighed 107, he weighed 230. And I had an English accent at that time because I'd grown up and brought up in Europe and in England. And I guess he decided that my accent was an insult to the American flag. Whatever it was, he really decided to get it in for me. And I remember at lunchtime he was trying to goad me, and I refused to respond. And finally he said, boy, I'm going to get you. And he came up to my room. Didn't have locks on our doors. I had a dresser pushed against it, but that was useless. He came in and began to beat me up. There was just nothing I could do about it. And he said, I'm going to throw you out the window. I'm going to throw you out the window. And the ground was three stories down. And I just took it. There was nothing I could do. And somebody later said, why didn't you cry for help? I said, because I wasn't afraid. Whatever happens, let it happen. Whatever comes of itself, let it come. Be always calm in yourself. Don't react. Nishkam karma. Don't have desire for the fruits of your actions. The more you can just remain calm and not react to the world and to the way other people treat you, the more you will have that kind of courage which it takes to walk unscathed